Okay, I guess we can probably start with a little bit of the history of this. Really, before around the turn of last century, internet radio was really a hobbyist domain. Back in its heyday, I used to go to ontheair.com, and it would have a listing of stations that both either broadcast exclusively on the web or had done both a simulcast of actual broadcast radio and internet radio. And I was amazed just about the variety of it because throughout my life, I've been raised with radio stations. Of course, I was never into the low power FM movement, and I was never really into hobbyist radio or ham radio or anything like that. And all I knew was if I wanted to get some good music, basically maybe I'd have to go to one of the alternative CD stores, certainly nothing like Sam Goody or anything like that. So when I found out about net radio a few years back, I saw that there was actually much more variety to music than I had ever even imagined. I knew it existed, but the actual concrete music there was just something to behold. And from there, I became pretty much a hobbyist, and I was just got so much in net radio that I decided, I would set up my own stations sometimes. They were usually I kind of come in and kind of come out, but really though, I don't think I had any more than maybe 15 listeners at one time. But really though, the whole thing was just a hobby. I mean, no one really said anything about it. I never, got any mailings from the Recording Industry Association of America saying that I needed to pay
Cease and
some
desist.
royal, yeah, some cease and desist order saying I needed to pay royalties. But that started to change a little bit with the climate that the Digital Millennium Copyright Act started to usher in, sort of a dark era in the field of online communications. And what had happened before was the only people who really paid royalties, as far as net radio is concerned, is those who could really afford it, which were actually real broadcast stations, those that relied upon broadcast media. So what happened was that the Recording Industry Association of America, by their own words, said that they wanted to usher in more regulation of not necessarily in an industry, but rather a medium that amateurs would enjoy for the express purpose of market consolidation, meaning that they wanted an act which would expressly limit the amount of players that would be within internet radio. So what happened is that they sent recommendations to the Librarian of Congress called the CARP, which is the Pat, do you remember what the CARP stood for?
No, it's not a fish. It's I can't even remember what the acronym stands for, but it was basically the fee schedule that they imposed upon webcasters. The first fee schedule that they wanted was like obscene. And I think what the mindset was is, okay, we're going to get some stupid politicians that really don't understand what's going on here. They're not going to accept our initial schedule that we set down. They're going to knock it down. So like even if it's 10% of what we're asking here, it's still going to be prohibitively expensive for the hobbyist, for the small-time webcaster to do anything with it.
To keep in mind that the previous one that they suggested was 0.014 cents per song per listener.
Yeah.
Beforehand, rates for broadcasters to pay royalties was never based upon listener. Most of the time, it was a per revenue model from which they would derive royalty fees per listener. For the vast majority, I would say in the neighborhood of 75 to 80% of web broadcasters' expenses would, of course, go over revenue, but in many cases, it'll double, even triple what any kind of revenue might get. And in many cases, it would be infinite because the revenue would be zero. It's a hobbyist.
Yeah. So now you're seeing all of these webcasters, small-time webcasters, are starting to dry up. And what is today, September 1st?
Today is the first.
Yeah, today is the day that it was supposed to go into effect. A new fee schedule was supposed to go into effect September 1st. And as if it wasn't bad enough that they're basically bullying out the small little guy by making this obscene fee schedule, they're also saying, okay, they're prorating it back 4 years. So 4 years back from today, September 1st, 1998, you owe royalties for every song that you have played since September 1st, 1998.
I don't remember what songs I played in 98.
Exactly. I don't have those logs anymore. And basically, you know, it's what do I want to say? There were probably a handful of webcasters out there that probably could have survived. They would have been like, well, we've never really made any money off of this before. You know, we can probably scrounge up, we can get creative, and we can probably afford a couple $1,000s per year to send out our stream. It really never was a cash cow for us. We do it because we enjoy doing it. We'll figure out a way to make a couple $1,000s in advertising or something, and we'll be able to hang, you know, we'll be able to hang on. But now, because they're saying, oh, you owe us not only royalties from this point forward, but this point back for the last 4 years, a lot of these small webcasters are saying, that we can't afford that. Where are we going to come up with $20,000 just like that? And
the only people that can really survive under this model who have just been web broadcasting is, say, Live 365, for instance. But the thing is, you get with these sort of companies a largely diminished audio capacity. Many times, if you wanted a very selective sort of genre for music, you would have an amateur web broadcaster who might, if not have a DSL, maybe even a T1 or a T3 connection, could broadcast a limited amount of 128 kilobytes per second for AOM signal. Yeah. But the thing, and that's probably around MP3 quality. The thing is that in order to broaden their audience, many companies like Live 365, they provide a pretty good service, but they do it at 44 kilohertz, right, which is basically the rough equivalent of AM radio quality.
Right.
And it's just so that they can split bandwidth
as much
as they can.
A lot of times also they'll, instead of webcasting in stereo, it'll be mono because you'll use essentially half the bandwidth sending out a stereo stream versus a mono stream versus a stereo stream. But, you know, the conspiracy-minded among us have really realized, you know, why is this happening now? Why is this? Does anybody know here what is the one limitation with webcasting versus traditional broadcast radio?
Receivers.
Mm-hmm. You need a computer. You need a computer. You need to be in front of a PC, physically connected to the internet to get a stream, right? Well, this is changing. Look at what is going on right now with wireless broadband. You're starting to see a plethora of new technologies that are emerging that are allowing you to get a broadband internet connection on your laptop. And one can very easily envision a future in the not too distant future. We're talking like maybe a couple of years where your car stereo is an internet receiver. There's a wireless internet receiver within your car stereo, and essentially somebody webcasting out of a basement in Boise, Idaho, you will be able to hear them as long as you can receive a wireless internet connection. Well, this is scaring the recording industry and the radio industry. You know, they're saying, oh my God, you know, Clear Channel's going to be in trouble if this happens because anybody is going to be able to pick up a stream. That's where I think they said something like the automobile is where like 90 or 95% of radio's listening audience, they listen to the radio in their car. And then the other 10% are people that are, you know, jogging or sitting around at home. But so that's been the limiting factor for webcasting from day one, is you need a computer. And this is getting ready to change very, very soon. And I believe there is it's not any surprise why they are trying to get a stranglehold on this and shut this down. They don't want this to happen, because once this happens, there goes their cash cow. They did this a couple years ago with low power FM, basically the NAB, National Association of Broadcasters, put a nail in the coffin of low power FM broadcasting. I was an applicant for a low power FM radio station license 2 years ago, and unfortunately, the powers that be killed that. And you know, they looked at what was emerging with wireless internet technology here, and it's pretty obvious. You just have to look at the big picture and say, oh, that's why they care now.
What's actually ironic is that they use net radio as partly a justification to suppress low-power FM, saying that, well, if somebody's a true hobbyist, then they can pretty much achieve their aims through net radio broadcasting.
Used to be able to.
Yeah.
We have questions here. We can go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up what the overall model is that seems to be it's built on was the bandwidth and the scarcity model.
Right.
So long as there were a limited number of bandwidths that you could sell around, then you had a closed set. The internet opened up the infinite set, and
exactly.
The values all automatically have to be renegotiated because it can't operate on a scarcity model anymore.
Exactly,
mm-hmm.
Exactly. And it's really cool when you think about webcasting. You can set up a radio station in your bedroom, and you can have a global reach. I mean, literally. That's this is unprecedented, the capacity that you have to reach a market. Was there another question back
there? Yeah, I was just curious. What exactly does this cover? Does it cover like songs that are
yes.
Like for example, if there's some bands here that might not necessarily have recording contracts, could you play those songs still, or does this cover all music in
this,
any form?
This is for music that is currently under control of the Recording Industry Association of America, the RIAA, which is basically about 99% of. Of what you hear, 99.9% of what you hear on commercial radio. I don't believe this covers like unsigned bands, like MP3.com. I believe they're going to continue to exist
mm-hmm.
because these are not artists that are signed and bound by the RIAA. So basically, you're talking about commercial songs that you're hearing on Top 40, that sort of thing.
In my case, I'll actually be restarting my defunct station probably later this month. But in my case, I mostly play Japanese rock and Japanese pop. So also, you can probably – I'm not sure what the legality is so far about bands that are basically licensed overseas because in many cases they're licensed by Sony. And Sony, of course, has subsidiaries in the United States,
right.
So it's kind of a hazy legal issue on that point.
Another comment in the back there? Did we? No? Okay. Yeah, really and truly, if you look at it, for all practical purposes, there are, really two gigantic record labels that exist right now. You've got BMI and all these labels like Arista and RCA, and these are all subsidiaries of BMI, BMG, Bertelsmann Music Group. And then you have Sony Music and labels like Virgin, EMI, that all are underneath their umbrella that are distributed by them. So really and truly, what you're seeing right now is a consolidation of the music industry. It's basically everything is being merged into one thing. And the thing that is really wrong on so many levels, and something that a lot of people seem to be missing, and including the lawmakers, is that, okay, wait a second, AOL Time Warner, Warner as in Warner Brothers, okay, they own a majority, I don't know, even know.
They own a shitload of licensing
they
contracts.
A shitload of recordings, sound recordings. Now, of course, they can go and set up a webcast, and who are they paying the royalties to? Themselves. So they can charge whatever they want. And, I'm sorry, if that doesn't smack of antitrust, I really don't know what does.
Well, a lot of it, the fuel of the fire, actually you could say the fire started to ignite with the 1996 Telecommunications Act, where really the old rule before then was that a single company can own more than two or three
right.
radio stations in a radio market. And when the 1996 Telecommunications Act was passed,
Hello
that was
Clear
simply,
Channel.
Yes.
Basically vacuuming up all these little mom and pop radio stations around the country and consolidating it. And it's really kind of scary. I mean, it's everybody would say, well, that's just business. It's natural for an industry to consolidate itself. But the amount of choice that you have is being limited, and that's anti-competitive. And, I don't think that any one entity should have the ability to go out and shut these webcasters down because, they simply can't afford to hang with the big guys. Question?
What's the current following in Congress? I mean, are there any people currently mm-hmm. working against reversing the
yes. Yeah. Actually, right now there's actually an act in Congress right now called the Internet Radio Fairness Act that was introduced even a few weeks ago. I'm going to go right now to a page, if it'll let me. Okay, let me stop that there. What you do is you go to. Okay, this thing doesn't like me very much.
Yeah, the RIAA still isn't happy with the fee schedule that they've got. You know, they see all these little companies drying up and folding up, but not everybody is going away like they had anticipated. So they're renegotiating the fee schedule. They say, oh, that's not good enough for us. So there is a glimmer of hope on the horizon. Hopefully some lawmakers will look at this, you know, when this comes back up and say, wait a second, what are you talking about? You know, hopefully somebody will come to their senses in Washington. I don't have great hopes for that, but, you know, there's always a possibility of a miracle.
Right, but in this case, what you should do as far as to help the miracle kind of occur is go to live365.com like I've done and click on Fax Your Congressperson. This thing doesn't like me very much. And what you do is it'll give you this form letter, and then I don't even know where left click is on this thing. Oh, here we go. Maybe this one. Well, no, that's just the track point. But you can go on. Okay. I'll try to figure out this.
What Lowell there's showing here is basically a pre-designed form letter for you to fax to the Congress critters say, you know, basically let your voice be heard on what's going on here. Yes,
yeah.
Thank you.
Although that doesn't really get updated very much. Even if weeks after the CARP decision was made, it was still like, save Internet Radio. Don't let the Congress accept the CARP recommendations when, in fact, they did. but, you know, keep checking. They might post something new.
Well, one can very easily envision something else going on. I mean, you know, you're going to start seeing pirate webcasters. that's a very real possibility at this point, is people just continuing to webcast on American shores, sending their stream out to a multicast server overseas where they don't fall under the jurisdiction of American law, and then the stream's coming out from there. So, you know, if they think they're going to get all webcasting to go away, no, it's going to get interesting. And another question here. Absolutely, you could do that. You could open up a put a server out on Sea Island or something, or in Canada even. You know, Canada's not. I don't believe Canada falls under. They might though. There's all this NAFTA crap and.
Isn't this a strictly North American United States?
Pardon me.
Isn't this the United States kind of deal?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. But I know. Yeah, or Mexico or wherever, right.
Or do what I did and start your own country in your household.
declare your kitchen a sovereign nation.
Well, I mean, China making pirate CDs.
Yeah.
China didn't have a copyright law in the U.S. yet.
Right.
The copyright, this is the thing, though. Usually in nations like China and in Southeast Asia and so forth, what we would call piracy is very rampant there. You can get bootlegs of pretty much anything. I mean, you go to eBay sometime and you can find basically bootleg anime from Hong Kong. I mean, it's the old joke that if an American licensing company doesn't bring in some anime, just go and get a Hong Kong bootleg. But in that case, what usually happens is that the State Department will, or the industry will urge the State Department to make a ruckus about the piracy.
Exactly.
And then usually what happens is that the companies, like the countries, will usually make a big deal. They'll even like get a steamroller to like crush some bootleg CDs. A PR move. And usually it's like, yes, we've made this agreement, whatever.
Yeah,
and it just starts again.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know. Exactly. They don't. It's very, very lax in Asian countries in terms of the enforcement of copyright laws. And you know, with the current state of affairs going on right now, I think a lot of these countries are just really laughing. They're like, why should we do you a favor at this point? What are you doing for us, basically?
Keep in mind that the Chinese government, about 95% of the Windows software that it uses on its own state machines is pirated.
question.
Yeah, I have two questions. First is there an organization or maybe a group of organizations of like amateur internet radio people who are working on this issue?
They exist. I forget though where the resources lie. Much of the chain, I think what's happened is that most of the amateur radio hobbyists have turned the activism role to larger companies like activist organizations. But as far as independent, more grassroots efforts to get the Internet Radio Fairness Act passed or get rid of the CARP recommendations, not much, at least from what I've seen on the web.
Yeah. My other question is that with the DMCA or whatever it is, it seems like a lot of the artists that work for the record companies are really pissed off because they're getting ripped off.
Yeah.
And a lot of ordinary listeners out there are pissed off because, you know, they want to download music or they want mm-hmm. more selection. And now a lot of internet radio people are pissed off.
Right.
Is there some way for like all of them and they're all pissed off at the same people.
Yes.
And they're, mm-hmm. you know, they're screwing us over.
Absolutely.
Is there like maybe one big,
that's the thing. It's the trick to try to turn pissed off attitudes into actual action.
Yeah.
The vast majority of people who were with Napster and when Napster collapsed, many of them just went to Nutella clients like Kazaa or BearShare and such. But the thing is,
yes.
But the thing about these people is most of the time they're just trying to find the next download fix. They're not really trying to say, okay, these companies are going after my own listening preferences and choices. What's something I can do about this so this doesn't happen in the future? So that, you know, I mean, you've heard about this new law they're proposing in Congress to allow the RIA companies to actually hack into your system to see if you've downloaded a quote-unquote pirated file. Many people, I think, don't pay attention to this until it's actually passed. And once it's passed, a lot of the damage can't be undone, right. Except maybe through a technical means, which would be basically, I've heard of some ISPs have said, if the RIA tries this, we're going to actively block their IPs.
Right.
So, but even then, not all, maybe some small independent ISPs might do this. Do you see AOL or Earthlink actually doing this? Yeah. Probably not.
Yeah, the recording industry right now, they're just completely and utterly clueless about how to go about this in a fair,
Well, they don't want to be fair. That's the point.
Exactly. Well, you know, I'm also doing another panel tomorrow night. Tomorrow morning. It's called Piracy as a Business Model. I think it's at 11 o'clock in here. It sort of ties into what we're talking about right now. It's 11:30 tomorrow? Okay. It sort of ties in a lot with what we're talking about right here. It basically addresses, okay, you know, piracy is not going away. You can police it all you want. You can pass all the laws you want. There's always going to be X number of people that are going to download their songs for free, that are going to go after pirated software and not buy it. You know, write them off as a loss and get on with your life is basically what I'm telling them. You know, get creative in marketing of their product.
But that's the thing, is that they want to eliminate web radio because they don't want independent artists to market their own product.
Right. So. Right. Now it's not, and I'm not talking about bootlegging. I'm not talking about pressing illegal copies, but you know, trying to shut down everybody who goes and downloads a song, or it's like holding back the tides with a broom, mm-hmm. basically.
Part of my motivation for doing Japanese music stationing or broadcasting is that I want to be able to have some sort of popularity develop in this country, so that I don't have to pay $35 to $50 per CD if I want to import one from Japan. Yeah. So,
but yeah.
I just wanted to. There's a historical precedent, I believe, for what you're trying to achieve with the what's that you're supposed to pay per song to the organization is.
They've set it at point.
RIA.
Yeah.
The RIA. ASCAP and BMI, what they do.
There was a fight between them, and eventually there was one that was like the new kid on the block, and the other was the old established.
Right.
And they actually
right? Yeah, the interesting thing is that the RIAA does not get royalties for songs that are played on the radio right now. Those royalties are collected and distributed by organizations called BMI, which stands for Broadcast Music Incorporated, and the other big one is ASCAP, the Association of Songwriters, Artists, and Composers, I think is what it stands for. They're the organization. They go and they audit radio stations. It's like they do it quarterly, and they'll pick, you know, a handful of stations in a market, and they will audit them, and they'll say, we want your logs from this point to this point, and we want to know all the songs. And that's how they calculate and estimate from there what to distribute in terms of royalty payments to the songwriters and the artists. What's really interesting is the RIAA, with webcasting, they're treating it completely differently. They're saying, well, this is our sound recording that you are, in a sense, people are downloading it. And I guess that's a fairly accurate description of it. It's not quite that simple because under normal circumstances, you really can't save a stream. I mean, there are creative ways around that to do that. But, you know, I just don't understand. I'm really confused by it all, just as I'm sure a lot of other people are. You know, where the RIAA is treating webcasting is completely different than broadcasting, than radio. In fact, they have gone so far as to say that there is no promotional value from webcasting. Okay? You know, where is that distinction made? I don't really understand it. They don't think that people listen to a webcast on their computer while they're working. You know, it is a promotional vehicle. And
are they saying that because they haven't been successful in filling the timeline?
That's possibly. Who knows at this point? Who knows what their thought process is? The recording industry, it's, you know, we talk about this every year. They I'm sorry?
They're very thick-headed.
They don't seem to, they don't, yeah, they don't embrace the new technology. They're scared to death by it.
The thing is that in many cases, it's about control. It's about the ability to hold on to a very outdated business model before. I mean, think about it. Oh, you want to go cross over to the other industry of movies in far back in 1982 when Jack Maloney was testifying to the House of Representatives. He was describing a new technology which would be like the Boston Strangler to the American consumer and which would cause the impending death of the movie industry. What was the technology? VHS tapes, yes.
Beta before that, yeah. Mm-hmm. They really, really fear and go in kicking and screaming anytime a new technology emerges. You know, they figured, I don't know if anybody has ever seen the buttons, they say home taping is killing the recording industry. You know, those have been circulating for like the past 20 or 30 years. No, it's not. I mean, they're still around. They're still making billions of dollars every year.
VHS tapes, too.
Yes, exactly. It we're talking about radio, but it goes hand in hand also with the movie industry. They just, you know, they're so afraid, and digital in particular, because you can make a copy from a copy from a copy from a copy from a copy, you know, basically, and your 1 millionth generation copy, of course, is going to sound exactly the same or very similar to your first generation copy. If it's a pure digital copy, there is no loss. You're just copying ones and zeros. And, of course, with sound recordings, analog sound recordings, that's not the case. With every subsequent generation, the quality degrades. And they are just tooth and nail scared to death of digital because of that fact that you know, your first generation copy is going to sound exactly the same as your 1 millionth generation copy. And, you know, but, you know, the when DAT first came out, digital audio tape emerged in the late 1980s. They were scared to death that, oh, you know, people are going to start taping stuff and making digital copies of our stuff and yada, yada, yada. You know, our sales are going to diminish and nobody's going to buy our product anymore. And that didn't happen. It has not happened. People, I still think, want the physical product, but, you know, somebody just needs to slap them upside the head and say, wake up. Question.
Yeah, so thanks. With low power FM, the strategy seemed to be, as the lady mentioned, scarcity of resource, can't fit the radio stations and the bandwidth, therefore you can't play.
Right. Right.
With the internet broadcasting, it seems to be strictly a royalty issue.
It is. It right. is. But right. bandwidth is not an issue. Bandwidth right. is not an issue. You can.
Okay. So let me finish the question.
Okay. Sorry.
So what I want to know is, has there been a legal precedent set for a person's right to webcast?
Oh, so as a First Amendment issue?
Yeah.
Most of the time they say as long as you're using somebody else's music without their authorization, then the First Amendment issue becomes essentially null and void.
Right.
Admittedly, it's – but that's kind of the difficulty is that they're saying that because you're using – you're broadcasting someone else's quote-unquote intellectual property that – you don't really have the right. You have the right to, say, for instance, strum a guitar on a microphone and record your own music, but that's about as far as it would go. But it neglects the obvious commercial benefits of actually broadcasting somebody right. else's music. And really, though, given the actual extra airplay, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that really stimulates CD sales.
Yeah, I guess my feeling is as long as we maintain the right to our webcast, that the industry will someday come around. What I'm scared about
right.
is people trying to stop us from actually webcasting.
You still have the right to webcast. Nobody is telling you that you can't. If you want to go and start up a talk radio internet webcast, you can do that, certainly, because you're not using any of the RIAA's resources or intellectual property. So it's not really a First Amendment issue at that point. Nobody's saying you can't go out and webcast. They're just saying you can't webcast our content, basically, is what it boils down to. Another question in the back.
Well, I was just going to comment on that. That, in a way, that's a hidden advantage because that forces people who want to do webcasting and bands who want to be heard through webcasting to provide content that isn't owned in that place.
Exactly.
It's bad in the short term, but it could be good in the long
term. I've proposed an idea, and I'm probably going to post a request for comments to the internet at some point in time. What I'd really like to see emerge is basically a nonprofit organization, gigantic cooperative of recording artists starting their own nonprofit recording industry, okay, where basically they'll produce the product, they'll distribute it, and distribute the majority of the royalties to the artists and the songwriters that deserve it, you know, maybe maintain a small percentage of the royalties from sales and airplay for operating expenses, but distribute the rest among themselves. Now, that would only cover newer recordings, of course. That's all fine and dandy. But you've really got the recording industry right now is really, truly, it's not like it used to be. I mean, if you have one flop of if one of your album releases flops, you are finished. I mean, look at what happened to Mariah Carey. You know, her one album got released right around you know, the movie bombed, and the soundtrack was released around from her movie Glitter was released around September 11th, so that didn't help sales either. I mean, it sold over 500,000 copies. It was certified gold. Okay. Most bands would be thrilled to death to have a gold record, but because she was used to selling multi platinum, you know, 10 million units of every album, her record label went eek, you know, and dropped her. Basically, I think they paid her something like $80 million as a release from her contract. It's like, boy, fire me. You know? What would really be interesting to see emerge, I think, would be an alternative recording industry where basically, you know, it's run. The organization is run and managed by people, movers and shakers, actual bands and musicians that work in the industry, and go out for the older artists who, you know, maybe aren't generating the millions of sales of their old material. Have them say, look, the RIAA is not going to pay you your your due for the royalties for your older recordings. So get back in the recording studio, do cover versions of your own hits. Record them so that they sound very, 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 very wink, wink, nudge, nudge, similar to your original recordings. And then those recordings can be re-released. They won't be subject to the RIAA's stranglehold. Yes?
So is your objection the concept of royalties or the fee schedule?
No, not at all. It's not.
We
not
want to see artists
with
get
royalties.
Paid.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. It's the obscene amount that they're asking. I mean, even a webcaster that averages, like, what, 15 streams per year is going to wind up owing thousands of dollars per year in royalty schedules.
And the way the scheduling is, it's on a per-listener basis.
Yeah.
That's what kills a web broadcaster.
If it was more in line with what they pay in royalties for radio stations to broadcast, that would be great. Of course, we want to see the artists get their due, and the songwriters get their royalties. But the amount that's being suggested and the fact that they are prorating this back 4 years is nothing more than a tactic to shut down the competition, basically, so they can go and set up their own webcast streams. Another question.
Yeah, the model that you're proposing for this group is not necessarily, it could be a nonprofit, but it sounds more like a co-op. Or
a cooperative,
like your
right.
credit union or something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly.
Or the natural foods co-op.
Sure, exactly.
But the model that you mentioned before about the Mariah Carey thing, and it's kind of a blockbuster profits approach that happens to the same thing with writers, which is that if you're the big bestseller at the front of the big chain bookstore, you're gravy. But if you're a mid-list, really decent novelist but you're not the big blockbuster, or if you're on your third novel and it's not selling millions, then you're pretty much dropped by your publisher. But the web is also picked up in that. There's all kinds of people publishing fiction online now. They're getting more hits than they ever sold as a mid-list fiction writer for a printing company.
You know, that's one of the great things about the internet is that these artists that aren't generating huge numbers for their publishers are able to go. You know, there are alternative sources of income for people. So it's not, you know, a completely dark and gloomy perspective in the future. But
well, that's the thing. If you look at the differences in industry and how civil liberties regarding those industries were set up, which really governs a lot of how they operate. The printing industry isn't trying to shut down independent authors who go on the web and sell books because, you know, when we were setting up the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, since we were setting up the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, print media was what the founding fathers really had in mind. Of course, oral speech came into that, but it was really the print, the written word, and this is the reason why things that are in print get far more First Amendment protection than things in broadcast. I mean, there's no FCC for print. There's no, you know, real government agency to try to regulate this sort of content. Whereas when you had in the 1920s the rise of broadcast radio, this was a time when federal intervention tended to be a bit steeper in those past 100 years, so that then there was a bit more of a silencing. The argument was that the broadcast stream or the spectrum is supposed to be public property and we have to protect the public property. But really, though, it's giving away the commons. It's just taking what really is supposed to be something for the public good and turning it over to private advantage. And now the trend is starting to continue because now we have a medium like the web, which operates a lot like print media as opposed to broadcast media. But they want to put not just the restrictions they have for broadcast media, they want to increase the restrictions they already have in place for broadcast media and apply it to web broadcasting. So, yes.
Part of the problem that you mentioned with your co-op was the idea that it's run by the band members themselves.
Right.
I can tell you right now, there's a lot of great bands out there, but they just don't know dick about how to
set up a gig
or how to set up anything like that.
Well, this would be not necessarily band, maybe producers, maybe retired guys. You know, in every organization, you'll find people that are you know, musicians that are high profile enough, but are also good speakers, have connections, are willing to put forward. You know, what I'm talking about is an elected group of officials. You know, if you're not doing your job, boom, you know, you're out. We'll replace you with somebody else that is. When you're talking about, you know, millions of musicians across the country, of course, the majority of them don't know Dick about business. But you're going to find at least a couple, you know, that do and would be willing to step forward and go to bat for the common good.
And under your model, I mean, this would be a cooperative effort. People who would be in the know to establish a viable business model, they would help these artists to actually know at least more than Dick than what they came in.
Yeah, there would be no interest for anybody to, there would be no ulterior motive, basically. You know, it would be a volunteer run effort, and like I said, you know, enough of the royalties split off to cover the operating expenses of this organization. You know, this could happen. I mean, basically, what it would take would be for somebody who is high profile enough to step up and say, you know what, yeah, we're going to do this. We're going to look after the old recording artists that, you know, the recording industry has basically given the finger to. And left out in the cold.
Well, there's been enough recording artists that have been so royally screwed over that I would definitely start with them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's where I'm you know, if somebody were to, like, you know, basically plant the seed, you know, do a grassroots type concept and propose it to the right person that was going to make this thing a reality and make it move forward.
Can't say I like her music much, but Mariah Carey as a spokeswoman would probably...
Yeah, yeah.
Let's let her get her revenge.
Yeah, that would... I think she was... I can't remember who she signed with, but she was recently picked up again by another label.
Oh.
And not all of them are stupid.
They could be coerced, though, by the record company saying, if you associate with those web broadcasters, we'll blackball you forever getting a contract.
Mm-hmm. Let them.
Well,
if they're running their own label, you know, basically...
Been doing it for years.
Yeah, and if there was a cooperative going on here, basically they would be blackballing the industry, basically saying you've screwed us over for too long, you know, we're not going to take this anymore, and you know, just shrivel up and die.
And you better believe Sam Goody would not be allowed under current marketing schemes to have any of this cooperative music on the show.
Of course, of course, you'd have to they'd have to create. There could be some legal wrangling going on there, you know, maybe some new alternative record stores would emerge that would be able to carry this content. But
that was the big fight between ASCAP and BMG, right?
What's that?
There was a lot of blackballing and stuff with the ASCAP BMG fight.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they've been at each other for years, you know, and they're supposedly nonprofit organizations as well, you know. But you know, there's definitely an interest at stake, and there was a lot of blackballing between BMI and ASCAP because they didn't want to relinquish rights to songs that fell underneath their umbrella. If a songwriter moved from one organization to the other, they wanted to maintain control over the original recordings forever and ever. I can't remember what the original schedule was for that.
It's gone on long now to where the years that someone can hold on to a recording has increased almost exponentially.
Basically, the record labels are treating it as a work for hire now.
Well, I was going to say, given, I mean, Annie DeFranco would make the perfect poster child for this because Annie DeFranco has never signed a California contract. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm curious about, I agree that using older artists that have been jerked around as a wedge is very good, but how are you going to free them from those, specifically the contracts under California law that give the recording companies essentially lifetime rights to their old material?
That's what I'm talking about. They would basically get in the recording studio and re-record very similar versions, cover songs of their own songs. Basically new recordings. I'm sorry.
I got to say that's difficult. I know that, for instance, one of the more recent Merle Haggard releases was a shot at doing that, and quite honestly, it just wasn't the original.
Yeah, it can be tough. It can definitely be tough. I know, and it's not going to be the original, obviously. You know, it's going to take a lot. It would take a lot of effort on their part to get it to sound very, very similar. But you know, it can be done. And if people eventually, you know, stop listening to the RIAA versions, and you know, that would be, I think, the number one stumbling block. Would people would be like, it's not the original. I don't want to bother with it. Clement,
can you talk a little bit more about the idea of the copyright holders holding on to their property for longer periods.
Oh, yeah.
There used to be something called, like, public domain or something.
Yeah,
like
it was...
I haven't heard anything about
it. It used to be, once
time.
Upon a time, in a galaxy far, far away. What used to happen was, I believe it was, you would make a sound recording, okay, and I think it was something like after, was it 50 years? 50 years, the copyright of the recording reverted back to the artist that recorded the album. They would maintain, they would get control of their recording after like 50 years or it was like 10 years after the death or 20 years after the death of the artist was the way it was originally established. The RIAA figured out a way to be creative about it, and basically now they treat a sound recording as a work for hire. What does that mean? Well, basically you're recording it for them. Okay, they're paying you to go. It would be like if you were to say write a software program for your employer. Okay, you don't have any rights to that because that is essentially a work for hire. You've been paid to do that. That's part of your job. They maintain control of that program, the copyright on it forever and ever. And that's essentially what the recording artists or the record labels are doing now, is they are treating new releases, new albums that artists are recording as a work for hire, which means the original recordings under that model will never revert back to the
musical
artist.
Serfdom at its finest.
Not
in our lifetimes.
No, not in our lifetimes. And I think they can renew it.
One of the things about copyrights, this was mentioned in a previous panel, was that the copyrights for works for hire can be renewed every 14 or 15 years.
Yes.
Original copyrights, like the most famous one is Steamboat Willie. Steamboat Willie was made in 1928.
Right.
Disney and Warner Brothers both lobbied Congress to extend the copyrights.
Yes.
As such, Steamboat Willie won't come up for public domain until 2013, before which they'll try to push for renewal again.
Oh, sure. We'll get new legislation.
Yeah. Did you know that before the Sonny Bono Copyright Extension Act that Mickey Mouse, the trademark on Mickey Mouse would have run out in 2003 for Disney and would have reverted to the public domain?
Yeah, they would never let that happen. No, it's...
It's very limited now, a lot more limited than it was even 25 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, if you release something to the public domain, yes, there is. But in terms of something reverting out of copyright into the public domain, they've gotten more creative on how to do this and how to maintain control over that intellectual property forever and ever.
And that's the reason why you've got even, say, recordings on, say, I guess, concerts, for instance, that happened 25 years ago, and some of the more hardcore fans of a band, like maybe the Grateful Dead, would, you know, beg companies, for instance, to just release these recordings, and they won't do it. So the only way that they were able to get their hands on the recordings was through Napster and Nutella, and in many cases through web broadcasting.
Right. Yeah. Any other comments, questions? Anyone?
I was just going to say, I think there's a real good shot at knocking down the essentially permanently extendable copyright, the case going to the Supreme Court this October. I think they've got a pretty good shot at winning that one.
It'll be interesting.
Well, it depends. I mean, the cord has had a 20-year right-wing swing towards it. The right, on the other hand, has been somewhat ambivalent towards copyright law and protection. Some cases it can go either way. But usually what's been happening over the last 15, 20 years has been more of an increasing acceptance of a corporate argument as opposed to an individualistic or a commons sort of argument. And usually corporate interests have tended to, not always, but tended to have succeeded better in this type of slant that the court's been taking over the past few years. So
I think there's something to what you said, but I also think that a couple of these right-wing guys, especially Scalia and Thomas, they're real suckers for original founders' arguments, and the language in the Constitution's pretty clear on the point. It's real hard. And that's the primary argument they got going for them. So despite the fact that I generally, like, really grit my teeth whenever I hear the Supreme Court these days is hearing a case involving civil liberties or intellectual freedom, in this particular case, I feel pretty hopeful. Generally yeah. speaking, what you've said is true. But in yeah. this case, I think that there's reason for hope.
Well, yeah, I mean, Scalia, Thomas, and Rehnquist, too, I mean, they're all what we call strict constructionists, which are basically those who would follow, they usually want to follow the Constitution to the letter and don't really interpret too much from the Constitution. The Constitution, on the other hand, I'm familiar with it a bit, but as far as what it says about copyright law, on the other hand, I don't think they have anything written in stone about what copyright law is supposed to extend to. I think if it's in there, it's more about reasonable and fair use,
sort of
principles. But again, right. That's the thing is that the Constitution is full of vague language, and of course, it's there. It's vague for a reason. It's so the founders figured that as time would progress, that legislatures and the public would interpret the Constitution in terms of the context of their own time. The thing is, the context of our own time has usually favored corporate interests a bit more, and because of that, the definition of fair use really can get diluted.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And part of the problem is because everything is so vague. You know, lawyers love that. they'll reinterpret and put their spin on a piece of legislation or something in the Constitution, and twist it to their own needs. I mean, that's what they're paid to do. A lot of them do it quite well.
Mm-hmm. One of the arguments I think has been used to extend copyright dates is that because the United States, the broad argument is that as the United States is moving from an industrial economy to a service and intellectual property economy, and the argument is that these companies can only survive if they can have their recordings or intellectual property or computer software or whatnot stay out of the public domain for a longer period of time, when in fact that's very untrue. And you could actually reverse the arguments on its head and say, well, since we're becoming more dependent upon intellectual property as an economy, maybe this is an argument to shorten the amount of time in which we have a copyright extended, because there's just so many more avenues to make intellectual property that once weren't there.
Right.
So,
okay. Anything
else?
Comments?
We've got a couple more minutes.
Yeah. What do we want to...
Bueller.
Anyone? Is this thing on? Can you hear me now?
Okay. Well, besides that, like I said, make sure every day, choose a time during the day, say during lunchtime, 1 or 2 o'clock, go to live365.com, click on where it says Fax Your Congressman, and do it every day. Encourage 10 of your friends at least to do it as well. And, you know, it's a start anyway. It won't guarantee anything, but at least if this fails, then they'll see there's enough public interest whether they can restart the effort just in case it might die in the House.
Yeah.
Oh, we got one more question.
Also, Congresspeople really still respect actual written letters.
Yeah,
absolutely. Also, do the typing and the printing. And
penning, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Email is just too easy to, like, fire off and spam them with a whole bunch of stuff.
Though I have to... You've got to admit, though, even like what I just showed, it's an actual fax you sent your congressperson as opposed to an email. I'll have to give a lot of activist organizations credit. They don't just have a form where you email the congressman. It actually initiates a fax to them from the web. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. But Any other questions or comments? I guess we'll go ahead and wrap up here. Like Lothar was saying, don't let this go. I mean, webcasting, unfortunately, if this comes to pass, you know, your choice of what you can listen to on the web is going to seriously diminish.
And remember, later this month, look for Shoutcast, KPMI, GenkiNet Radio.
Woohoo! All right. Thanks a lot, folks.